You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Liam Hanson tōku ingoa. Nō mai, haere mai, ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Ramade Thursday. I'm your host Liam and I'll be with you for the next hour. E whāki nei, coming up on the show, I spoke to Robert McCulloch from the University of Auckland about the recent reports on Aotearoa's stagnant inflation. I also had a chat with Te Herenga Waka, Victoria University of Wellington's Dr. Mona Jeffries, about long COVID and reports on how the pandemic has been handled over the past few years. We also heard from Troy Murray from the University of Auckland about a possible new life-extending drug that's currently being tested on mice. And lastly, I spoke with Nicola Ruse from the University of Otago about a research project utilizing citizen science to track kēkeno, aka New Zealand fur seals. He aha o whakaro, I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so please get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai, you can text me on 5395 or waiamai rā, give me a call in studio on 309-3879. Also after the show, ka aua e wareware e ahe ana koutou te whakarongo ki ene kōrero, ano he pakiari rokiroki maranga i te pai tukutuku o irirangi pōho, ma haere ki 95BFM i re kātikon. You can catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
New data from Stats New Zealand has recently shown the rate of annual inflation in Aotearoa has remained stagnant at 7.2% per annum. Food, construction and airfare prices have all gone up. However, the dropping prices of fuel have led the mean to being balanced back to where it was. The news came in conjunction with the swearing-in of Chris Hipkins as the new Prime Minister yesterday, who has said that his biggest priority is the cost of living crisis for lower and middle-income New Zealanders. To learn more about what the numbers mean, I spoke to UOA economist Robert McCulloch, first asking about if the stagnant rate is good or a bad sign.
Well, it's not a good thing. It would have been better if it had been falling. The most striking feature of the number is that it's not falling, whereas it is falling in the world's largest economy, the United States. And it's also been falling in the UK. But American inflation peaked at around 9% last year, and now it's between 6 and 7%. So it's come off its highs quite substantially in the United States, but it's not falling here. So what I take out of it is that it throws quite a lot of doubt on this narrative from the government and the Reserve Bank that our inflation is due to overseas factors. In fact, these numbers have shown that food is going up steeply, food prices, whereas food prices have been dropping significantly internationally. So there seems a strong domestic reason, cause behind these numbers. So that's a bit worrying for them because it's not coming off like it is in other countries.
We've also seen the cost of fuel go down, which is different from the food and produce, which has all been going up. Does this make a difference for most Kiwi families, or is it only really beneficial for those who are driving cars?
That's the tricky thing that you've just alluded to with inflation. The numbers, when you break it down, the consumer price index has hundreds of different items, and so they affect different people, you know, differently. And people who are more dependent on, for example, cars to get to work or petrol are particularly, you know, affected by, that's right, petrol cost changes. And the cost of oil and gas has fallen quite substantially over the last 6 months. Of course, it shot up during the start of the Ukraine war. But the drops in energy prices are part of the reason why overseas inflation has been falling. And it's played part of a role in dampening price here. But these domestic price pressures and, you know, coming from things like food have more than offset that. So, you know, of course, the general price index is still not coming down.
Looking at comparing ourselves to different countries, Stats and Said do have a table available here showing that, yes, indeed, the United States of America, as well as Canada and Japan, do have a much lower inflation rate than us right now. But we're also seeing some countries such as the United Kingdom and the average of the OECD and the European Union being more than the 10.5% to 11.1% range. Mm-hmm. What do you think countries like those in North America are doing right that we can maybe adapt versus those in the United Kingdom and Europe that we could also maybe try and avoid?
Well, my view is that the new Prime Minister, Hipkins, has been extremely naughty, if not downright misleading, in trying to run this line that Grant Robertson has run, that just a few days ago described inflation as a pandemic in this country. They're trying to kind of brainwash Kiwis, if you like, into thinking that the whole reason we have inflation is overseas factors. And he mentioned today in his first speech as Prime Minister that it's higher in Europe, as you said. So, oh, well, of course, we're more clever than the Europeans. We're doing better than them. It's a global thing. That's very, very misleading. And they've Grant Robertson and Orr, and now the Prime Minister is repeating that line. And your question exactly goes to why that's they shouldn't be doing this. Because if you look at much of continental Europe, they had a great deal of dependence on Russian gas. We import no Russian gas whatsoever. And German industry has been largely dependent on Russian gas. And in particular, aside from oil prices, those gas prices after the war in Ukraine blew up went through the roof. So there are very, very different factors driving inflation in continental Europe than driving inflation here. So I think this idea that they're trying to shift blame away from their own policies, the Reserve Bank printing $50 billion of money, the government's borrowing and spending program, and saying, well, they're more clever than the Germans because inflation is lower here. I think that's very naughty. I don't think they should be doing that. I don't think they should be playing the Kiwi public for fools. I mean, the inflation rate in Europe is being driven by some very, very different factors.
So that being said, what are the main factors that you think are driving inflation in New Zealand right now?
Well, this has emerged in these figures that were released today. People are paying very expensive tickets for travel. Air New Zealand's put up its the price of air tickets phenomenally. And also, in a country, we produce enough food in this country to feed 50 million people, and we're only 5 million. So we export enough food to feed 45 million people overseas. So there we are producing 10 times more food than we eat, and food prices are skyrocketing up, whilst at the same time they're dramatically falling overseas. And in construction, we're suffering from these extremely high construction costs as well. So, you know, there are a lot of domestic factors that seem to be driving these price increases that are explained by you know, local conditions.
Part of that, in the form of local conditions that some people have pointed out, is the fact that supermarket chains, especially the duopoly that we have right now between Woolworths and Foodstuff, are taking quite a big cut of the money that's coming in from groceries brought in Aotearoa New Zealand. Do you think that this is something that needs to actively be sought out to change? Perhaps it's a policy that the Prime Minister could now implement if he's trying to focus on bringing down hardship for lower and middle income New Zealanders, as he's mentioned as one of his goals?
Well, because we're at the university, we should have hard data, and I don't have, it's very hard to get the data on competition. It's quite a hard thing to measure and track over time. But my gut feeling is that over the last few years, because the borders of this country were shut for such a long period, is that competition, if anything, has declined in many key industries rather than increased. And we have a bit of anecdotal evidence for that. During the lockdowns, it was the government strengthened the monopoly position of the supermarket chains, the big supermarkets, because it was illegal during the lockdowns to buy food from anyone else. Restaurants were closed and all the small food outlets got shut down. So it, you know, when the government then handed the two big dominant chains total monopoly powers over the lockdown period, It also paid the wage subsidy scheme, which I think was a mistake, to the biggest companies in the country, not just small and medium firms. And Fletcher Construction is still sitting on $70 million that it got from the taxpayer for that. So you have, there you have dominant firms in food and our most dominant construction company. And of course, when borders were closed, you can't get, you know, it was difficult for foreigners to come in, for maybe an overseas person to come in, to immigrate to New Zealand, start up in competition for capital and goods and services flowing across the borders, even for locals to get out and compete. So my suspicion is that the market position across a swathe of industries here was actually strengthened during the coronavirus period. And if that's true, that's a very deep structural problem that the government, that the Nats and Labor have, how to do a structural reform to try to get down the cost of living by addressing those competition issues.
So with that being said, what do you think that the next steps are for us to try and actually take aim at this cost of living crisis and see it brought down, ideally for the current Prime Minister before the election, if not just in general for the sake of New Zealanders?
My view is they don't have a clue what to do. That's as close to the truth as I think, because I don't think it's a straightforward problem. And I haven't seen one thing out of National or Labor which is going to significantly dent the cost of living in this country. So my suspicion is, if it is related to deep-level competition problems, then it's not going to be a simple thing to solve. And the idea that you can just simply argue, as has come up in the media, maybe you can put in a new form of tax. Well, that's just about redistribution. It's not about addressing the root cause of the problem. So I've seen nothing from the two major parties that are going to make much of a dent in the cost of construction or the cost of food or travel over the next year or two.
You keep saying the root cause of these issues. I'm still not entirely sure what you believe these root issues are.
Well, I believe, you know, in this economics, since, you know, this is, you know, this student radio, in when we do economics classes, you know, we talk about prices may rise because of things going on. You might get high prices because maybe demand is increasing, or it couldn't be related to the supply side. And in the 1980s, this country did what were called supply side reforms. They tried to deregulate, cut taxes, privatize. They tried to reduce costs and make industry more competitive. Those reforms were very controversial because it was argued they increased inequality. But that was really the last time there were major supply side reforms that were done in this country. And that's exactly what I'm referring to. And my view is we've drifted for about 30 years now since the 19, when those reforms ended. And a lot of vested interests have strengthened over that time. And we need to go back to some quite radical, if you like, supply side reforms, but with a difference from the 80s, where we protect those who were affected with training, with skills, folks who could be at the wrong end of restructurings. We have generous unemployment insurance, so we handle the social consequences better. But I think that's what the country needs to do. And I don't see anything from National or Labor that they're going to take us down that path.
That was Robert McCulloch from the University of Auckland chatting about his views on the current rate of inflation.
The Wire.
I don't know, and frankly the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
Really great to see all of your views coming through on the text machine. If you'd also like to get in touch, tuku pahi tuhi mai, you can text in on 5395. Coming up next, we've got a quick tune. This is Babylon's Burning by The Ruts.
Burning with anxiety. Babylon's burning. night. And with anxiety.
For the first time in 5 years, Lord, live at the Outer Fields at Western Springs, March 4th. The long-awaited tour, from pure heroin to melodrama to solar power.
Though we're fine with this, we didn't come for money.
Don't miss Lord, with special guests Marlon Williams, Phaser Days, and Ricky Reed. March 4th at the Outer Fields at Western Springs. Get your tickets now from Ticketmaster.
Doof, 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 ding.
Bike Rave is back and coming to the Orake Basin, featuring the one and only Dan Ox.
The most fun you can have on two wheels. Bike Rave takes you on a group ride ending at Orake Basin, where you'll park up for a silent party at the water's edge.
Made possible by Auckland Transport, Bike Auckland, Club Mate, and Interesting Things.
Bike Rave Orake with Dan Ox, Saturday, February 4th. Tickets are free but extremely limited. Reserve yours now at Eventbrite.
All right, spot time, I reckon.
Got any utensils? We'll sacrifice some, eh? We're gonna need a vessel too. I'll scale the last of the sparkling duet.
Wait.
Yes, yeah, spot's on!
Whoa, nah, I mean the beer spot, you know? Amazing, independent NZ beer.
Ah, the legal buzz, gotcha.
The 95 BFM Drive Show, a fully legal, three-hour psychedelic playground of japes, jive and jams. 4 to 7pm every weekday, only on 95 BFM.
Thanks to the beer spot, your tabby place.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
Although many have been heralding 2023 as the first year in three without COVID over our shoulders, the truth is that the virus is still out there. Recent reports have been reflecting on the support in place for those who were suffering with mental health issues during the worst parts of the pandemic, as well as various other issues within the government's response. They also focused on long COVID and the disproportionate lack of support available for Māori and Pacifica. To learn more, I've spoken to Dr. Mona Jeffries from Te Haerenga Waka, Victoria University of Wellington, a principal investigator in the report, to learn more about the findings.
That's right, but actually just to say it wasn't only about long COVID, it was about the impacts of COVID. So we were looking at people who'd had COVID and looking to see how that impacted them across loads of different domains. So we're looking at health, we were looking at social well-being, financial well-being, whānau and family well-being, cultural well-being. And we found across each of those domains that people who had had COVID were significantly impacted in many different ways. I guess the really key thing that stood out for us was that mental health was a real struggle. So for people who had COVID-19, and we looked at people who had COVID before the Omicron outbreak, so up until the end of November 2021, people were included in our study, and the rates of anxiety and depression were really, really high, way, way higher than people who were impacted by the pandemic in other ways but didn't have COVID. So we've compared our results to the national report that the New Zealand Health Survey put out. We also found that the rates were much higher in Māori than they were in non-Māori. So we had our study was set up comparing tangata whenua with tangata tiriti. And within tangata tiriti, we had a very strong Pacific team, and the rates of mental distress were very high among Pacific people as well. When we looked just at long COVID, then the effects were even more stark. And when we looked at people, disabled people, so tangata whaikaha Māori and disabled tangata tiriti, then the rates were even higher. So we know that disabled people are already disadvantaged in many ways in terms of accessing care. And when we see this much higher level of mental distress and even higher barriers for disabled people trying to access mental health care, then that gap is really, really huge. And that's one of our biggest recommendations, is that the mental health services really do need to be responsive to the current pandemic and future pandemics as well.
What has been holding back these sorts of responses within the last year? You said that the research period, the surveying period, ended at November 2021, correct?
That's correct, yeah, but obviously it takes us time then. So we included people in our study who had COVID before then. We then had to do the study and then had to do the analysis and the reporting. So yeah, that obviously does take time, but there's no reason to think that the results would be any different for people who have experienced COVID during the Omicron waves that we've been experiencing since then. So I think the effects that we're seeing are unrelated to the variant of COVID and more related to the context of people's lives and the huge impact that the pandemic is having on people in terms of loss of jobs. So we know that people lost their job because they had COVID, because they couldn't turn up to work. We know that people lost their jobs because of generally the pandemic as well. Obviously the cost of living is rising, you know, on unprecedented rates, and that's putting real stress on families who are trying to cope. When we're looking at long COVID, then the physical ongoing effects are having really big mental health impacts as well. So people are struggling with loss of identity. Who am I now? I used to be able to go to work. I used to be able to help out at the sports club. I used to be able to go for a run. Can't do those things now. People have lost their jobs because they're too sick to work. And long COVID isn't recognized as a disability. And so that means that the benefits that people with long COVID are entitled to are means tested based on their partner's income. So if you live with somebody who is able to work, then you are not eligible for the benefits you would be eligible for if you had a recognized disability. And yet the impacts on people's lives if they have long COVID are huge. So about half of people with ongoing COVID symptoms at 3 months, which is how we define long COVID, were unable to fulfill their usual activities to a moderate or severe extent. So we used very standard questions that have been used across the world, and we found really similar results to the international evidence as well, that the impact of long COVID on people's mental well-being, social well-being and financial well-being is enormous.
Are there any fundamental changes that you think now need to be made to better accommodate to the people who've been dealing with long COVID, especially those who are disabled and those who are Māori and Pacifica?
Absolutely. So we have made a call for a national long COVID centre. So it's really important that services are put in place at a national level so that we don't create more inequities than we already know exist. So we know that there are places, particularly for rural people, where accessing services can be really difficult. We know that Māori have faced real barriers in accessing primary healthcare because of cost barriers and because of being unable to register with a GP. So it's very important that those barriers are not perpetuated in what we do new. So what we're calling for is a national long COVID clinic working with primary care providers and really importantly working with community level providers, iwi providers, Māori health and social services providers, Pacific health and social services providers, because those are the people who we know supported people with COVID throughout the pandemic, particularly when levels of isolation were really, really high. Then those were the people who understood their communities and knew what those people needed and wanted and were able to provide the care and support that people needed. So what we don't want is to just suggest that we do what we've what's often been done and roll out some kind of service which has inequity at the heart of it, because that's what happens when we use the type of services that we have always been using. So we're calling for a complete shift in mindset for a national centre which will coordinate and work with existing community level providers who are doing an amazing job.
And on the note of inequity, part of what you noted in a recent statement was that some of the issues that have come about with the government's COVID response could be considered as te tiriti or waitangi breaches. Why do you think this?
Well, we know that right at the beginning, then virtually every Māori academic and public health provider got together. They formed an amazing group, and that group were not listened to right from the beginning. And it was only when the rates of vaccination for Māori seemed to be low and weren't meeting the same levels as they were for non-Māori that the government and the Ministry of Health started listening to the people who knew. But those people knew right from the beginning because they organised themselves in March 2020. So what we are calling for is that the financial support and the autonomy is given to Māori providers who know how to reach their communities, know how to deliver care in a way that is accessible and appropriate, and the level of focus is taken off exactly what those people are doing with every single dollar, and instead the trust is given to iwi, to Māori providers, to say, here's the funding that you need to deliver your services, do it in the way that works. And that is essentially what co-governance should look like, and that's what we will be calling for.
And lastly, this is an election year. Why do you think that it's important for New Zealand to continue keeping the pandemic in the front of their minds when voting this year?
It seems to be unbelievable to think people couldn't continue thinking about the pandemic. We are all living with the ongoing consequences, and yet some people are impacted much, much more. So my call would be to all of those political parties to focus on the people who need your help most, to focus on the people who are living with the greatest impacts of that pandemic. So we need to start thinking about really overhauling the benefit system because so many people have lost their jobs because of the pandemic and because of health. So, yeah, I guess that would be my very strong call, is that we don't focus on the people who don't need your help yet. Maybe the ones you're voting for, you should be thinking about the people for whom the pandemic has had the greatest impact.
That was Dr. Moni Jeffries speaking about long COVID and her reports into the government's response to the pandemic. We're going to go to a quick ad break.
Bust out the sprinkler and set your lawnmower to stump. Gardens Music Festival is the brand new inner city garden boogie, taking your summer by storm at the stunning new venue of Auckland Domain. Featuring a headline performance from living legend Fatboy Slim, plus LPGOB, Sedmo, Peking Duck, John Morales, and more. Gardens Music Festival, Sunday, January 29th at Auckland Domain. Get your tickets now from gardensmusicfestival.co.nz.
What's a seven-letter word for Street Fighter?
No idea. I know that tonight at Ponsonby Social Club there's
DJs Carlotta, Maioha and Momo.
And tomorrow
DJs Takas and Katya.
Same old Ponsonby Social Club, 152 Ponsonby Road.
It's music.
We played it first.
BFM, the original originator. Broadcast to the world and podcast to your device on 95BFM.com.
So it's a very odd time to be alive, as they say.
The Wire.
Nutrition researchers from the University of Auckland have recently been testing a new drug that is speculated to have life-extending properties. Alpelisib is showing evidence of extending the lifespan of mice by 10% and is showing signs of the process being healthier than usual. While they are a long way off, the researchers have been speculating about their ability to bring the treatment to humans. We heard from Troy Murray from University of Auckland about their studies.
Well, it's long been known that inhibiting a molecule called PI3 kinase in lower organisms like flies and worms can extend their lifespan, but we didn't know whether this held true for mammals and therefore could be translational. So the development of a cancer drug that targeted PI3 kinase provided us with the opportunity to test its effects in mice on lifespan and health span. So what we did, we aged some mice till about 1 year, then gave them this drug in their diet and monitored their health until they died a natural death. What we found was this drug can improve lifespan of both males and females by approximately 10%, and it showed some increases in health span markers such as strength and coordination. However, a caveat on this, that the mice treated with the drug also had some negative effects of aging, showed more negative effects of aging in terms of reduced bone mass and elevated blood sugar levels, which we would not want to see in human aging.
How long has this research been going on for?
Aging research is a really long-term project. Probably we initiated the study about 5 years ago, and there's still a long way to go before we can think about translating this work to humans.
So can this drug be improved upon within its current state, or is it limited at the 10% mark?
We think there is probably room for improvement. There's still a lot of work to be done on this area. We've only tried this one drug that is already commercially available and clinically utilised for cancer treatment, but we may be able to make tweaks to this drug. We'll use co-treatments of diet and exercise to further extend lifespan benefits. But most importantly, we want to focus on quality of life and health span. It's no good living longer if you're not living healthier and being able to be more engaged in society.
So is this drug more likely yet to be seen as a medicalized drug or something that should be involved in one's nutrition and diet alongside other things that you mentioned, such as exercise and your quality of living?
So at the moment, this is a prescription drug, and any targets like this will be a prescription, but that's not to say that now we understand this pathway, what this drug targets, we can think about looking more at more natural forms of manipulating this pathway through diet and exercise. And ultimately, there's not going to be one approach to extending lifespan. This is just one piece of the puzzle, and it gives us a new insights into aging in mammals and can help us target both diet and exercise.
Do we know what it is particularly about alpelisib that leads it to having these properties?
We know what it targets. So it targets insulin signaling. So it's kind of a trade-off, because if you have very poor insulin signaling, this is when you get diabetes, but this drug targets that pathway. So if we gave too much of this drug, you'd get diabetes. But we think it's a trade-off that you want a little bit to reduce the amount of carbohydrate or sugar you utilize and change your metabolism. This is a hypothesis, because what we actually saw, there was no consistent mechanism. We found quite different molecular signatures of how this drug affected both males and female mice, even though they both lived longer. So this is kind of an open question, exactly how the drug is improving health span and lifespan.
Are there any current dangers or fears that you and your team are trying to work through with this drug?
Yeah, look, there's a couple of things we need to work through. One is we saw that this drug reduced the bone mass of the mice. Even though they lived longer, mice may have less reliance on bone mass because they're smaller as they get older, but we know brittle bones is a real problem of aging in humans, so that's quite a cautious area we need to go into. The other thing we need to be really cautious on here, this is just one study and one strain of mice in one animal facility, so we need to make sure this replicates across different places with different mice and has good safety profiles before we go towards humans. And the third thing is we need to work on is, can we make a slightly different and change this drug to make it more safer and more effective, because we know what the target is now.
Is that a part of your goals, to see this drug shifted towards human usage?
Yes, certainly. As I said, it's a long-term project to get there, but this is really great first steps, particularly because really there's only a couple of drugs that have ever been shown to consistently extend lifespan in male and female animals, and this one in particular is already used for cancer treatment, so we know it has at least a somewhat preferential safety profile. It's something we can work with because we know it's been used in humans before.
And what sort of changes do you think need to be made between now and then to see this project come to fruition?
I think we need to be really sure of our results by replicating it in different mouse strains and different conditions. And we need to be really sure of the safety. While we said this drug is taken in cancer, this is normally a short-term intervention where we need to know the safety profile in healthy humans and how this will affect healthy humans if it's taken long-term before we go to really long-term trials.
So what are your primary next steps in the short term? What are your next aims with your research?
I think our next steps would be around finding out whether we can tweak this drug and change it slightly to make it more efficacious and safer for the treatment. And also testing out whether this is reproducible in different contexts, such as in different animal facilities, different mice models, to make sure it will then translate to humans. Because the mice model we used are all very, very similar mice. They're genetically quite similar, but in reality, humans are all very different. So we want to make sure this holds true in a whole lot of different scenarios.
How does one practically change and modify medical drugs like this? Is it just balancing out the chemicals?
Yeah, basically little chemical changes so we can design slight drugs that act in slightly different ways but target the same target, so we can change specificity and the amount of dose needed for that drug.
Do you have any final thoughts or interesting things you'd like to share with our listeners?
I would just really like to thank the Health Research Council of New Zealand, which is a government-funded research funding body that supports this basic research and the emphasis on continuing this sort of funding up that can then lead to translational research in the long term.
And where can people go along to follow along with this work?
Keep in contact with press releases from the University of Auckland, Twitter and places like that. We'll try and make all our results public as they come through.
That was University of Auckland nutrition researcher Troy Murray talking about alpelisib, a new drug that has possible life-extending properties.
I don't know how to say this. Betelgeuse star?
You're not a child of the 80s. If you were, you would know the film with a similar name. The star is Betelgeuse.
Oh.
Yeah.
The Wire.
This is some Foom with Be Your Boy. We've got our last story coming up after this. That was Carry the Sorrow by Bill Despil. Just before that, we had a little bit of Voom.
Well, what a phenomenal thing for you to say.
The Wire.
A project aiming to track the lives and mortality rates of Kekino, aka New Zealand fur seals, has recently been approved for extension. The Department of Conservation project was originally slated to take place from June to November of last year, getting citizens to become involved by submitting photographic sightings of the seals in various places across Aotearoa. To learn more about their next steps and how the extensions will benefit the research, I spoke to Nicola Roos, a student at Otago Uni, who is assisting with the project.
Yeah, so New Zealand's Kekino population is growing in size and range and becoming increasingly visible to New Zealanders. So between 1st July and 22nd November of last year, DOC conducted a public awareness campaign urging people to report sightings of Kekino around the Coromandel and the Hauraki Gulf. And from this, DOC received 102 reports of Kekino between July and November, and these sightings were spread across the Upper North Island, with 36 in the Waikato, which included the Coromandel, 27 in Auckland, 14 in or around the Hauraki Gulf, and 7 each in Northland and the Bay of Plenty.
What has your involvement in this project been like?
It's been a huge learning experience and a great master's project for me so far with Otago Uni. Getting an opportunity to work with Laura Boren at DOC and her colleagues has just given me a much deeper insight into wildlife management and conservation in New Zealand. My main role is to gather the sightings data for the Kekino into a spreadsheet and create a map of their distribution from this, and hopefully determine some key haulouts or breeding locations in the Upper North Island.
How have citizen volunteers been involved in this project?
Basically, without the New Zealand public sending through their sightings to the Kekino DOC inbox, we would be really limited with the number of sightings that we're able to work with. So the citizen science has been really outstanding in enhancing our understanding of fur seal numbers and their distribution across New Zealand that we really wouldn't have had otherwise.
What sort of impacts do Kekino have on the local environments?
So Kekino play a really vital role in the ecosystem. They feed mainly on squid and small fish, as well as being prey to larger species in New Zealand waters, such as sharks and orca, even leopard seals. They're also just a really engaging species, which New Zealanders have come to know and love.
Is it an issue that the mortality rates may be rising?
So of the sightings that we accumulated from our call to action in 2022, 81 were for live animals and 21 were for dead animals. And this was actually a positive result, as there were significantly fewer dead seals reported than over the previous winter and spring in 2021, where we found that there were more than 50 dead animals.
And what sort of conclusions have you drawn from this research so far?
So sightings are increasing, and like I say, from at least the data we've accumulated over the last year, dead seals are decreasing. There are influences that could be factors such as weather and food availability, but so far it is a positive trend.
How does this extension of the project assist in your research?
So the decision to extend the project into summer will deliver more valuable data on one of our most visible and interesting marine species. So in summer, obviously, more people are out enjoying the coasts of New Zealand and the ocean around us. So there'll just be more eyes helping us identify seals and provide us with sightings. And in addition to this, the extension into summer allows us to look for Kekino across a really important time in their life history, as summer is their breeding season. So we're on the lookout for pups as well. The project area has also been expanded to cover areas such as north of Kawhia, up along Waikato's west coast, and Whakatane on the east coast.
And if people want to get involved by submitting their own sightings, where can they go to do that? How would they do that?
Yep, so just jump on to your email, send us an email through to kekino@doc.govt.nz, and we would really appreciate any sightings that the New Zealand public can put through to us.
That was Nicola Roos, a Otago University student who's supporting the DLC in their efforts to track Kekino, aka New Zealand fur seals.
That was The Wire.
Cool. Ko ira te ho takakatoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi kia koutou katoa I kōrero mō ki au mō tēnei rā. That was a wrap on the Thursday Wire. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. Robert McCulloch from the University of Auckland, Victoria University of Wellington's Dr. Mona Jeffries, Tori Murray from University of Auckland, and lastly, Nicola Roos from Otago University and the Department of Conservation. Nei rā hoki te mihi kia koutou I whakarongo ana. Thank you for tuning in. The 1-4 is up next. You're listening to 95 BFM.
That was a 95 BFM podcast. Support 95 BFM with a B-card. Go to 95bfm.com/signup.